Hi, I'm Nancy Friends, and I am a grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Nancy.
And I have to turn my phone on. My phone is 14 minutes fast. It's gone from 10 now to 14, and we cannot solve it. So I have to set the stopwatch. That's the only way I can do this. My home group is the Hope Al-Anon Family Group on Monday at 11 a.m. in Yuma out at Gloria de Cristo Church in the foothills. And during the summer, my home group is the Thursday Night Courage to Change meeting in Sholo, where Mary is from over there. I'd like to thank Sherry S., who asked me to speak. She is not able to be here because of health issues, but we really look forward to her return next year. I came into Al-Anon, it would be 45 years, just about this week, in 1981. My son was 6 months old when I came in. I do believe many things in my life have been God things and little miracles. For years, I probably would have said that I ended up in Al-Anon because I married an alcoholic. Today, I'm grateful that Mike came into my life because without him as my obsession, I might not have found Al-Anon. I would have probably just kept on working at solving all the problems of the world and making sure everyone and everything fit into this neat little box in my head. I qualify for Al-Anon because of my thinking that it was my job from an early age to fix everyone and everything, and certainly never admitting powerlessness, at least not out loud. I was raised in a religion and did not come away like many others with bad feelings. I always believed there was a God. There has to be something or someone out there that provided all these amazing things in my world. I just didn't see God as a personal God. He was there for floods, famines, tornadoes, things like that. And we were kind of raised to not bother whatever God there is out there with our petty little things. Today, one of the gifts of my Al-Anon program is that I know I matter, and my problems and concerns and challenges are important and worthy of attention by my higher power. When I came into the rooms of Al-Anon, I questioned if I qualified to be there. I thought someone in the rooms would tell me that I couldn't come because I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. I did grow up in a very controlled home. I do know today that my parents did the best they could for all of us. We all grew up to be good people, good citizens, hard workers. There were 9 kids, 6 boys and 3 girls. I was the 3rd oldest, the oldest girl. My dad was an electrician and my mom was a stay-at-home mom. All of us were raised to believe we were intelligent to solve all of our own problems and everyone else's problems also. But my dad was tough, and things had to be a certain way, the right way, his way. There was no abuse, no violence. I do think a couple of my brothers probably got spanked, but never the girls. We all just knew you didn't want dad to find out about certain things. Very little alcohol was kept in our home. Mom and dad would many evenings have a Manhattan. That is one Manhattan. Not two, never two. I do believe that my dad was an untreated Al-Anon who was determined that his wife would never be like her family members. We all heard the stories about the Egans, the good Irish Catholics. That was her side of the family. And my dad never saw any of them as positive influences for our family. Over the years, though, that the Egan aunts and uncles all was kept in contact with the kids. We have a great relationship with the Egan side of the family. We loved hearing their stories, and there's always humor and laughter. When we visited, we'd like to go back to the back porch where my grandpa would be putting an egg in his beer. We all thought that was just a kick. There were 10 kids in that family, and I do know that 2 of them had alcohol problems. But the rest of them did not, although you wouldn't know it from what my dad told us. My maternal grandfather did freeze to death on his way home from a bar in Chicago. I always thought my Uncle Tom was a drunk. But when we visited him in Chicago a few years ago, right before he died, I found out he hadn't had a drink in 50 years. My dad always said Mom's sisters were all hooked on prescription meds. But actually, I think my dad was uncomfortable that my aunts spoke up for themselves and didn't seem to just do as they were told, as my mom would do. I think my dad operated out of a need to control and out of fear for what might happen if he didn't have a really tight rein. And I know he raised a large family, and having only had 2 kids, I can't imagine having 9 that you'd have to raise. We had everything we needed, but maybe not everything we wanted. My parents instilled in us a love of travel. Mike will tell you that a Sunday drive in that home meant hours and hours and hours. They promoted reading in all of us, and to this day, you will rarely see myself or any of my siblings out anywhere without a book, just because we might have a few spare minutes. They also gave me the love of Disneyland, as evidenced here. While there was only so much to go around with a large family, we would get to Disneyland almost every year. And to this day, I go as often as I can. At that point, you'll hear me talk about the inequities between men and boys and girls, privileges. And we'd go to Disneyland when they had the ABCDE tickets, for any of you who are old enough to remember that. But the boys were the only ones who got the E tickets. I never got it. I only got a D ticket. After high school, I went on to junior college where I dated the class president. Bob was, I believe, an alcoholic. I say that because we would go out and he would drink like a fish. I would ask him why, and he told me that he had been married previously and divorced, and his parents told him he was going to hell because of the divorce. And so he said he was actively choosing to drink himself to death. At that age, I just remember trying to reason with him and tell him that he could still have a good life. At the time, he drove a Corvette. And when he drank too much, I would take him home to his house, and then I would have the Corvette until the next time we would go out. Not a bad trade-off there. My younger siblings loved it, as they would vie for who got to get a ride to school in the Corvette the next day. It never dawned on me that alcohol was the problem. I just thought it was his religion, his belief, his parents, and that he was just using alcohol to make life more tolerable. Now I kind of figure if I looked at his family and himself, it was probably alcohol. I always wanted to be one of the guys. I'm definitely a tomboy. The boys in the family had much more privileges than any of the three girls did. I wanted to play baseball. I did not want to play softball. I did play softball, but I wanted to play baseball. I was Catholic. I didn't want to be a nun. I wanted to be able to be a priest, and we practiced. I can do the whole mass for you. At that point, girls couldn't be altar servers. Now they can, but they couldn't back then. That's what I wanted to do. While age has slowed me down, I'm still pretty proficient at basketball. My grandson, when he and I started playing a few years ago, was very surprised that I could hit the outside shots from the sidelines. And I said, because the guys were always too tall for me, so I had to learn to do that. I wanted to be a Boy Scout. My dad was the Boy Scout leader. They had a whole lot more fun than the Girl Scouts, but no such luck. It's exciting today to watch my granddaughters who are now playing flag football. And I'm so jealous, but so glad that girls have come so far. As I said, Dad ran the house. All of the kids really wanted Mom to speak up for herself and take a stand, but that wasn't in her makeup. When I left home, I realized how that affected me, and I made an active decision to never have a man run my life. I do have to admit that I probably took it to an extreme. I became more like my dad than I like to admit. At our meetings, we sometimes share about saying, "You might be right." During an argument, and my fellow members know that even after 45 years in this program, I am still not able to say that with any honesty to my spouse. It's always going to come out sarcastically, and he's going to know I'm lying. But if I keep coming back, maybe I'll get there. When I considered going to college, Dad said he wouldn't pay for my education because I was a girl, and I was just going to get married and have kids. Again, that was the world back then. Well, I was going to show him. After spending time in Prague, Czechoslovakia, on a student exchange program after my sophomore year of junior college, I enrolled at Occidental College in Los Angeles, majoring in, get this, diplomacy and world affairs with a Russian emphasis. Get me there. At that time, I spoke English, Spanish, French, Serbo-Croatian, and Russian. I look back and I know I had no sense of self. Or perhaps I wouldn't have acquired all those student loans and come out with really nothing useful in my world because I didn't have any confidence to go out and follow up. I really was smart, but I didn't have the confidence to go out there. So instead, after graduation, I took a job at American National Bank, which was basically a collection company for student loans. What a waste of an education, but I was afraid to go out in the world. This is where my story with Mike begins, as he worked at that company. I really wanted to date the boss, but he wasn't interested, so I pursued Mike. They say opposites attract. Well, Mike and I started on the same page, or are probably one, maybe not the only similarity, but the biggest one is that our birthdays are 3 days apart. And so we are bull Scorpios. Now that's where the similarities end. He loved to drink. I didn't drink much. I couldn't drink much, you know, half of a glass of something and I was out. He still gives me a hard time if we are out and I order a margarita and I don't finish it. He tells me that's almost sinful. He smoked pot, I didn't. Now that was an issue of control. I did not want to look stupid, as he and his friends all looked. Luckily, we didn't have cell phones and stuff that you take pictures and videos and stuff. He is fairly conservative and I am fairly liberal. He's more black and white. I live more in the gray area. He's quite outgoing and I'm pretty introverted. He's pretty laid back and relaxed. I'm organized in the planner, and some might call me anal. He's quiet. Nothing is really worth arguing about to him. And I'm sorry to say that anything is worth arguing for me. I'm going to prove my point. We probably got together because I was an Al-Anon a training and he was an alcoholic and we needed each other. I remember sitting on his back porch and he was pretty wasted and had just had a crazy conversation with one of his family members. I knew all he needed was a good family who would love him and show him how good life could be. I didn't know he was an alcoholic at the time. I don't even think I knew the word alcoholic. But he will tell you, as he's told me, that he was an alcoholic then. My grandson Dylan, for Christmas last year, gave me a book. It's something like Grandma, Tell Me Your Life or something. And it's pretty cool. And I'm supposed to complete it and give it back to him. But I hit the part where it asks about how I got engaged. I realized that I couldn't put an honest answer there for give it back to a 12-year-old. Mike and I were living together, and he'd been up late listening to his drunk mother, and he got drunk in response. He then came to bed and mentioned getting married, and I remember the next morning having to ask him if he was serious. So that story isn't going to go into my grandson's book. Some stories are better left untold, so I'll just kind of make up something. I don't know why I was willing to accept the type of life, but I did. Not sure if that's all I thought I deserved or what. Irregardless, we got married and our life in this disease began in earnest. I knew what my job was as a wife. Remember, this was 1974, and I can never remember that lady that had that book out there that tells you that you're supposed to meet your husband, you're supposed to be all dressed, your hair done, your makeup done, dinner on the table, the kids were supposed to be quiet, that kind of thing. Very quickly, I realized that I was failing at my calling. I was not a good enough wife for him to stop drinking. Now, I will admit I've never been an easy person to live with. I honestly will tell you that I might have been drinking if I was married to me. And so that fed the belief that I was failing, and I was the cause. I couldn't seem to keep him on the straight and narrow, and I certainly didn't want anyone in my family knowing that I wasn't capable of running my home. Now, it wasn't like it was a secret to them. It seemed as if I left home, there would be trouble. Within the year or two after getting married, my sister-in-law passed away and I flew back east for a funeral. And a couple days into it, I got a call that he had had an accident. Now, what he said was he was bringing some wood home in the back of the car and the load shifted. Now, what really happened was he was drunk. So after a few of these escapades, the whole family kind of joked with me that I shouldn't leave him home by himself, because something always happened to him. He obviously needed my guidance. We had kids in 76 and 80, and luckily for us, we found a program called Marriage Encounter. That was a gift and a miracle for us. It didn't address alcohol issues at all, but it did give us some tools of communication. It probably saved our marriage until we could find Al-Anon and AA. Also, I had a good support network with some other mothers in a play group. We shared our stories, lives, problems, and really supported each other during the time. During these years, life spiraled. He worked a lot, I was at home with the kids, he drank a lot, and I bitched a lot. Because I was the cause of the drinking, I tried to control what was going on. I was intelligent and capable, and I was going to figure out how to cure this craziness, because if he just stopped drinking and smoking dope, we would be just fine. But you and I know that's not true. So I came into Al-Anon in March of 81 in West Covina, California, and I'm so grateful for my friends who introduced me to this program. My friend Diana, mother from the playgroups, who went on to become a social worker and had already divorced her alcoholic husband, never came into our rooms. Today she has a severely alcoholic son, and when I last spoke to her, she has chosen not to come to Al-Anon, but she told me that she continues to read the ODAT every day. And so I know that having the literature out there does give relief and serenity to people, even if they choose not to attend a meeting. At a meeting we read from the recently, we read from the Paths of Recovery on step one, I was struck by the sentence, the first word of the first step illustrates an important concept in Al-Anon recovery. We are not alone. I had spent many hours sitting on our turquoise couch, the color of Peter's shirt. God-awful couch. In Laverne, California, trying to figure out how to contain, control, cure Mike's drinking. He would come home and ask me when I was going to get off the couch. And I would say, when I figure things out. That was the point. It was an I. But when I came into Al-Anon, I found this WE program, and thank God I did. I found a group about 35 miles from where we lived. We were in Laverne, and this was in West Covina. And what a great group of men and women. But I walked into the first meeting in this building that was a converted bar. And so you walk in the front door, and there's the bar is there, still there. And all these guys are sidled up to the bar. And I thought, what in hell have I walked into? But I continued through the building and found the Al-Anon room. And everyone was loving and hugging each other and laughing. It was someone's birthday, an Al-Anon birthday. And so there were cakes and presents. The group believed in using the tools of the program, a very strong group over there in Southern California. They worked the steps, the traditions, they read the literature, they believed in having sponsors. And because I was a people pleaser and wanted them to like me, we had a retreat, an Al-Anon retreat about 5 months into it. And I quickly got out my step book and I started working those steps because I didn't want to go to that retreat and have somebody say, now, have you worked your steps? I wanted to say, of course I have, you know. Thank goodness for that group. Really jump-started my time in Al-Anon. In my meeting, that meeting, there were several speakers that shared around the nation. I kind of call them circuit speakers. To this day, I can sometimes find updated CDs. Again, I'm going to date myself with some of these things, CDs, with their stories, which I really need to see where they are today. In that area, we had access to weekend retreats, conventions, speaker meetings. We've been down to the San Diego convention a lot. Mike didn't know at the time that I was going to program until about 6 months in, and then his response was, because he worked in Los Angeles, why don't you go up and get a billboard on the tallest building in LA and tell everyone I'm a drunk? No, I don't know, it's 50 miles away from where we lived. In my early days, I thought the members would tell me that I couldn't keep coming back because my life was pretty tame. In this meeting, one of those circuit speakers talks about her having a knife and her husband having a gun at each other. And I'm thinking, man, I don't know. But they assured me that my story was just as valid as theirs and to keep coming back. When I came into Al-Anon in March 81, we had very little literature. This was our literature here. I think there's five books, and I think there was one more book. And one of them was this, the Big Book of AA. At that time, we still used the Big Book of AA in Al-Anon. Now we're, it's like this, go away. But in our meetings, we had the ODAT, the Dilemma of the Alcoholic Marriage, Al-Anon's 12 Steps and Traditions. The Blueprint for Progress had just come out the fall before I came in. Lois remembers. And, of course, the Big Book of AA. We have come a long way since then. This is the copy of the latest order form that of all those books that Beth has back there. We have over 20 books available for Al-Anon, Alateen, 10 booklets, 30-plus pamphlets. We did use, as I said, we used the big book. Because the Blueprint for Progress had just come out, we did the four-column method out of the big book. So 4 through 9, I followed that book. And then the Blueprint for Progress came out. And that was really beneficial to me because I kind of came in thinking that there wasn't a lot of good about me. And so the Blueprint for Progress, it has that chart at the end that shows the traits. And so I could see that I really didn't live only on the negative side. Some of those things had positive sides. Some of this, you know, my planning was really beneficial. It didn't have to be over here. But I could live in kind of the middle, so I really liked that part of it. My first sponsor gave me the big book, and I have her inscription in that book. During this time, I still continued working on Mike and his drinking. I'd like you to believe that I was a good Al-Anon person, and I stopped, and I heard all this stuff, but I didn't. After he picked up a DUI, he was mandated to attend 6 AA meetings. It was pretty minor penalties for DUIs back in those days. So I quickly researched good AA meetings with professionals in suits and ties so that he would find like people and be able to bond with them. Did he go there? Absolutely not. He found some meetings in downtown LA with the dregs of the earth almost. I thought that was the reason he didn't get sober then. But I know it was because it wasn't his time to get sober. I can remember complaining to my sponsor, and again, I'm going to date myself here, complaining to my sponsor on a regular basis that a good wife is supposed to have a meal on the table, a hot meal when he comes home. So I'd cook a meal. I wasn't a great cook, but I cooked a meal, and it would be ready, and he'd be in the little Mexican cantina in downtown LA and didn't come home. And I called her on a regular basis complaining about this. And one night she said, "Nancy, they have invented this thing called a microwave." That's how long ago that was. She said, "You can buy those, and then you can make the meal, put it in the refrigerator, and have it ready." And it's like, okay. So a very minor little solution solved that problem. We moved to Houston for a year, and again, I found another sponsor and group, again, about 30 miles from home. My first sponsor was a circuit speaker. And so she did a really dynamic speech. My second sponsor in Houston was a stand-up comic, female stand-up comic. And so it's like, okay, how do I possibly compete with these people? Hold on, left a page. So we spent a year and a half in Houston. And then Mike was offered a job in Veracruz, Mexico. And I remember asking my sponsor whether I should make that move to Mexico because of the alcohol and the drinking. And she said, "Okay, do you think he's going to drink in Houston?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "Do you think he's going to drink in Mexico?" And I said, "Yes." So she said, "Well, it sounds like the only question you have to answer is, do you want to live there?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I do. I spoke a lot of languages. I think it'd be a kick." So started a crazy 18 months. I took copies of my ODAT and the 12 and 12 and the big book with me to the meetings down there. I had, by that time, we had, over the last, say, 8 or 10 years, they had started translating the English books. So I had copies in English and in Spanish. I would follow as much as possible in Spanish, and when I got lost, I'd pull my English copy out. I'm very glad by that book that we had those translations. Going to the meetings wasn't very anonymous or confidential because the meeting room was in downtown Veracruz, and I mean, the entire wall of the outside was the triangle. So anybody who knew the triangle would know where I was going. But, you know, at that point, you just don't care much. Because sitting in the rooms with those members, even if I didn't understand what they were saying, was my priority. For that hour, I felt serenity and peace. I can tell you that I never really believed that Mike would stop drinking. I always hoped, but didn't believe. In October of 86, Mike took the kids with some friends and they went to the golf club. Now, why I was allowing the kids in the car with an active drunk is beyond me, but I did. When they pulled back into the garage, Mike told the boys he would take them swimming. He was so drunk he couldn't get out of the car. The boys were six and 10 at the time, described their horror as Dad almost took out the parking arm at the golf club and gotten way too close to the edge that drove along the ocean. That day I knew I was done. No one had ever in these rooms had ever told me I had to leave, which I really appreciated. They did tell me that one day I might wake up and decide I was done. Well, that day I was done. I knew I was. I had threatened divorce before, off and on, until Mike said to me one day, if you ever say it again, that's where we're going. And I never said that word again. But this time I knew I was done. I could see that we had threatened the kids. I had put them in danger and he had put them in danger. I was able to call a friend back here in the States who arranged for him to enter a treatment center up in Wickenburg, Arizona. Our friend said, oh, you have to leave right away. And Mike said, no, I need a couple weeks to get my things in order. He was running a company down there. And so he agreed, our friend agreed that he could stay those couple weeks. And so for those 2 weeks, I became the friendly alcoholic. So I had my big book, and every night I'd sit and read to him. I was so happy to turn him over when I dropped him off at the treatment center. He started arguing with the people about the cost because it was all out of our pocket and that maybe he would leave. And I said, oh, you might leave, but you ain't leaving with us, you know, so you might want to stay here. You know, in treatment centers and in program, they mentioned it today, you're told not to make any life-altering decisions in the first year of recovery, whether it's get in relationships, move, change jobs, etc. Well, Mike's company did give him the time off to go to treatment, but asked him not to come back. So, and what, before, when we had left Houston, we had sold our car and our house. So we came back to the States with no house, no job, and no car. We didn't have a choice to keep things the same. And no matter what the professionals told us, how much of a mistake it was going to be, we really didn't have a choice. So after much talking, we realized we might never have the opportunity again when we would have no bills. No electric bill, no water bill, no bills of any kind. And we could just do anything we wanted to. So we bought a van and a tent. And for the next 10 months, we and the kids traveled the United States. We would get up in the morning and go, which way do we want to go, literally? And if somebody said, oh, you got to go up there, we'd go there. We didn't plan to visit anybody. We just decided to kind of heal as a family. We had our AA and Al-Anon books with us, and thankfully lots of, now again, here's our dating, the cassette tapes, remember the cassette tapes? From speaker meetings and conferences and conventions. So when we couldn't get to meetings, we were able to sit by the campfire and put in a tape and have a meeting. You have to remember that was a long before Zoom meetings were available. To this day, our kids remember the time and treasure the experience. Although along the way, we ran into people who had some concern because our youngest was always telling people we lived on our car. And you know, they just don't. Sounds like you're homeless. We were not homeless. In late 87, we ended up in Yuma as a result of another of those God moments. I grew up in Phoenix, and Yuma was not somewhere we even liked to drive through. So the thought of living here was something else. But God had other plans for us. Mike interviewed in a job that we thought was a job in California, and it ended up being a job across the border in San Luis, Mexico. But it was at California Pay, and they offered him the job then and there as a general manager. And you just don't have that normally. So here I came to Yuma. We've had a good life with wonderful people in our lives through this program. My sponsor, Norma, and her friend and her husband, Jack. Mike's sponsor, Orman, and his wife, Edith, all gone now, but remembered dearly for all they brought into our lives. They weren't just sponsors, they really became best friends. I'd like to have you think that sobriety was the answer to everything, and that it's been a bed of roses, but life isn't like that, sober or not. In 1990, I returned to school, got my master's degree in counseling psychology, and became a drug and alcohol counselor, and then on to a marriage and family therapist, specializing in working with families and friends of alcoholics. I was so grateful for what the program gave to our family that I regularly referred my clients to Al-Anon and AA, but things got difficult in my life with that. The more people I referred to Al-Anon, the less comfortable I felt sharing my personal issues in meetings. When you're in training to be a therapist, you're told, if you're sitting with the client, you don't share your story. And so to go into a meeting when I'm sitting with three or four of my clients, it's like, okay, how much should I be putting out there? And then I'd have clients come back into my office telling me something, and I'd say, why didn't you share that in the Al-Anon meeting? And they said, yeah, but if we come to you and we don't want to bother you with our problems in a meeting. So it just really became crazy for me. So I stopped attending local meetings. I would go if we were out traveling or at a convention, but I never found the personal closeness that I had in local meetings. I wonder how things might have been if we'd had Zoom meetings at the time. That would have been a blessing back then, and I'm grateful that Zoom meetings are now available so that most anyone, anywhere can go to a meeting. This was another miracle that our marriage and relationship survived this time. Luckily, God stayed with us, and we made it through until I retired and came back into person into our rooms. At the time of my retirement, I had hundreds of self-help books on my shelves to use as a lending library. Most of them went to the AWC library, and I got a great tax credit for it. But I can tell you that even with all those books, the most used part of my lending library was the section of the Al-Anon books. I bought lots of copies over the years as I gave them out with hopes that my clients would end up in our rooms. It was very interesting reading through Many Voices, Our Journey, which is a history of our program, and finding out more about the actual history. In the beginning, groups used just about anything they wanted in the meetings. I mean, it talks about the Bible, Emmett Fox's things. I mean, there's a whole list, a whole page of, you can use all of this stuff in the meetings. And even when conference-approved literature began to be worked on in the early 60s, groups were still able to put out their own literature, but they couldn't call it Al-Anon literature. But we could put out anything we wanted on our tables. Outside our meetings, I do use outside books and resources with my sponsees. I actively try not to mention any outside book or literature in our meetings. I strongly believe in using conference-approved literature. Now I do have to admit, and Ronnie mentioned it early, that I have been known to slip and mention Dr. Phil. He has that saying, she said somebody else told her, but it's that, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? Well, I don't know. Being right some days. Looking back when I came into program, if other members had shared outside information in the meetings, I know myself well enough that I would have run right out and bought them and tried them instead of focusing on Al-Anon. When I'm in a meeting and someone starts talking about other literature or podcasts or whatever, I cringe and worry about the newcomers or just the newer members. As a newcomer, I wanted anything that would have the answers. And by bringing in outside stuff, I fear that we will see those persons and books as certainly having better answers and quicker answers than our program. I mean, I came in because you had 12 steps, and I'm an intelligent person. I can do 12 steps, and then I can graduate and go on. So the thought that 45 years later is like, oh. So if somebody handed me a book and said, oh, you really need to read this, you know, Dick, our friend Dick, who's since passed away, was always talking about some TV show or some radio show or some book. And I would have latched onto those when I was new. For years, I had managed and controlled our finances. I paid the bills, wrote the checks, did what I wanted. Then Mike decided he wanted to take over that part of our life, and that was tough, I have to admit. I knew there'd be no problem. I mean, he's great with money, but I was used to doing anything I wanted without anyone looking over my shoulder. Now, I didn't totally give up because I still to this day have a small checking account at a bank where I operate my business out of, and I really should close it. But it's just, I can't do it. It's still going to sit there. I keep it, I think, because it's my mad money. I buy gift cards to get gas points, but also because when Mike doesn't pick up on what I might be doing, then he doesn't know if I take the kids somewhere. Not that he'd ever tell me no. I know this is old stuff that came from my dad and my mom, of my mom taking a couple bucks out of the groceries and putting it in an envelope, and if one of the kids needed something, she'd slip it to him. I don't know if Dad ever knew about that mad money, but I assume he wouldn't have been happy. But Mike is not my dad, and he might complain some when I'm taking my grandson out to Wingstop, but he's not going to do anything more about it, and he loves the kids and loves me and has worked hard to provide a good life for all of us. In 2013, Mike decided to retire the following spring, and he came to me and asked if I'd ever heard of the Camino de Santiago. It's an 800-kilometer, 500-mile walk, climb, hike, crawl across Spain. You go from Spain across the Pyrenees to Santiago. And I reminded him, he had heard about it at Rotary, and I reminded him it was 500 miles. And at that point, Mike didn't go to the gym, and he didn't do, you know, long distance walking. And I'd been doing marathons and half marathons for some years. At that time, it told me it's like doing a half marathon, which is 13.1 miles every single day for 36 days. But he said he wanted to do that as a spiritual journey. So began many miles of training and walking around Yuma. People would see us walking from the foothills into town. Now that's 13 miles from our house to my son's office, 16 to where we used to live. I have it all mapped out with our backpacks. Or around Smucker's Park, when Smucker's Park, because it's a mile thing, so we go round and round and round. We left in April 2014, spent a wonderful, peaceful, spiritual time walking, and some days for me, crawling up mountains from France through Spain. And again, the miracles we encountered in everyday life, the people we encountered along the way, and Bill W. is alive and well wherever we went. One day, Mike was having a particularly hard day with a steep downhill section, and I went ahead and got some beds at the hostel. When he drug into town, he introduced me to Bill O'Sullivan, a friend of Bill W.'s from Ireland, who had stopped to help him, and they discovered that they were both recovering alcoholics, literally in the middle of nowhere on a mountain trail in Spain. Has to be a God thing. After Spain, we became sunbirds. We lived in Yuma during the winter, traveled around the U.S. during the summers, looking for cool weather for several years. Now, I do have to admit, our travels didn't bring out the best in me. I am not the best passenger when my husband is driving. It is not his driving that's the problem. It is my passengering. My dad taught us all to drive, and we are all good at that, but none of us are good passengers. I didn't mind once we had the trailer parked and we were set up. And I loved that part, but man, that was a challenge for me, and the best of me did not come out. What's funny now is that when we came back last year, I was appointed driving instructor for my then 15 and a half year old granddaughter. Jocelyn said I was the calm one in the group and was able to sit in the passenger seat and not react. I don't know how. I bet my husband would love it if I could do that for him any day of the week, but no such luck. In 2020, with the advent of COVID, it became harder to find places to park a trailer around the United States. So a friend told us about Juniper Ridge Resorts up in Sholo in the White Mountains. And after a year of renting, we bought a place there, and that's where we spend our summers now. We knew nothing about program possibilities in the area, and again, everything was shut down with COVID, until we were walking around the park one day. It's a park of about 500 places, and there's this car parked in this garage, and it has a little triangle on the back of the window. And so Mike went and introduced himself to Gary M., found out that they had been holding a meeting in his backyard once a week for quite a while. So he found a meeting. It took me another year before I found the Al-Anon meeting up there, as they also had been meeting in a private home or in parks and things. Small group of Al-Anons, but there are four meetings that I can get to with good recovery. The interesting piece about our park, and I was telling somebody in line over there, is that we probably have a dozen active AA members with spouses, and besides me, no other spouses go to Al-Anon. They don't even want to talk about it. They know I go, but I don't know. I don't know how those spouses stay centered and peaceful, but I can tell you that comes Thursday afternoon, I'm so happy to head into town and go to my meetings and get hugs and support from the others. We have walked through some hard times, everyone does, as life happens. Losing loved ones to death, the divorces of our sons, the stress on the young grandchildren, and some health scares for both of us. Our program gave us the tools to live together and love each other always, and like each other most days. Miracles continue to work in our lives, even when at times I try to lean too much on my own human resources. Mike continues to love me even when I might not be lovable. Even today, I can be hard to live with. He will tell you that he can't think of anything I can change. But just remember, he's an alcoholic and he lies. One of the other issues I had to work through over the years is how to deal with Mike's family. His mother had a severe drinking problem and some mental illness that we finally figured out. His dad became a paraplegic after he contracted polio when Mike was young, and so lost custody of the kids. One of the big problems over our marriage was his mom, who would call at really strange hours and not very pulled together when she would call. I struggled to be a nice person. It's very hard. You know, you can, when we had rotary telephones, you can accidentally hang up on somebody pretty easily, not intentionally, of course. Al-Anon principles helped me to be able to at least say hello and maybe chat for a few minutes. That was all really I could do. When we would go visit, I'd go over once, and then the rest of the time we were there, I would send him over lovingly, you know, because that's, his mom wanted to see him. She really didn't want to see me, and that was really okay. I was able over the last few years to make some amends to his family by being active in his sister's life. She seemed to have the same mental illness that his mother had but didn't drink. Most of the family would have nothing to do with her, literally for years, but we got involved when she was hospitalized and then deemed unable to live on her own. For whatever reason, I was able to deal with her most days and act as her advocate. She passed away last year, and we know this was a blessing for her. She was a very tortured soul. Today, our lives don't involve any active alcoholism. We don't have alcohol in our home. One might think that our boys, who are grown, our son will be 50, and the other one, 45, so 46. you know, you'd think, I always thought, okay, they came in when he was, Mike came in when they were 6 and 10. They've lived in a program home. They won't drink or anything like that. But that's not true. When the boys started experimenting and we would have conversations with them, the oldest would say, I'm going to drink different than Dad. And the youngest would say, I'm going to drink better than my brother. We work hard to stay detached with love from our adult children and their lives and choices. We struggle to not step in too quick to do for them what they should do for themselves. Our eldest son got a divorce about 10 years ago, which was hard on the 3 grandkids. But we made ourselves available for the kids and continue to do so. And we make sure that we're at as many events as possible to cheer them on. In fact, we're missing a flag, or the initial girls' flag football tournament for Yuma County today, to be here with you. And they can come out and hang out with us as much as they want, but you know, they're 17, 15, and 12, and you know, they're getting to that point. Our youngest son, after 26 years, got a divorce about 4 years ago from a woman he had been with since they were sophomores in high school here in Yuma. She had been a thorn in our sides the entire time, and I wouldn't tell you what we called her, but we know it was his choice to be with her and his life. We do believe she has an alcohol problem, as evidenced by incidences in her life. She was a mean drunk, but it was not our place to interfere in his marriage. At one point, he had to tell us that none of our family was welcome in his home because she forbade him to allow any of us to be there. My longtime non-program friends all told me that I needed to tell him to stand up for himself and straighten her out. They didn't understand that it's not my life and my choices. All we could do was pray and be there if he needed us. But my job was to work my program and allow him to live his life. As it happens, they did divorce. And he's met a really nice young lady who likes us and who calls me to find out, when are you coming and how long you're going to be there? And the first time she did that, I said, why are you asking? She said, well, so I can plan stuff. And I said, well, you have to know, when Michelle was around, she would call to find out how long we were going to be there so that she could not be there. So I said, you actually want us to be there. It's so exciting. They get along great. And it's a joy to see him, my son, happy. I work hard to not offer opinions, whether asked or not. I may offer information, but not opinions, as you've all taught me that it's not my life they need to live. I may think my opinions are in my head, but I try hard for them not to get expressed. In January of 21, I was elected district representative for Yuma, and I get to work my program with other members of my district and at the state level. I was the group rep for the Hope meeting, and now I'm the group rep for the Monday Night Choices meeting. I do admit that it's frustrating to see how slow decisions are in the making in Al-Anon. We have to do, for those of you who aren't familiar with the state level, we have to present it, and then we have to have a thought force to think about it for 6 months. Then we have to have a task force to work on it for 6 months. And I'm going, oh my goodness gracious. I used to always say, if it took me that long to get something done, I'd either be dead or cured. Sometimes it feels as if we're staying stuck, but I continue to pray for guidance and patience. That may be the wrong thing to pray for. I have thought about quitting a few times, but have availed myself of the wisdom of other members to guide me. I have met some good people who continue to work with me. I do look forward to seeing my new friends from around the state at our business meetings. I have also learned recently that my minority opinion on issues, such as the Al-Anon state budget, is valuable and should be expressed even if it's not popular opinion. I used to sit at the tables when they'd be discussing something, and I'd be grousing with whoever I could find to mumble with underneath our breath. But I didn't want to get up to the mic and say I disagreed because you all might not like me. And today I can get up, you get 2 minutes, and I can get up and do my 2 minutes. And if nothing else, it gets everyone thinking and not just blindly voting. We like this unanimity, this unanimous stuff. And for once, it wasn't unanimous, and that was okay. Now I realize that what I have to say, as long as I say what I mean what I say, and don't say it mean, that's okay. And my husband walked out, but I know my husband can hardly believe, there he is, that I'm not vocal when I disagree, since I'm pretty darn vocal with him when I disagree. But I tell him that's because I know he loves me, and other members in Al-Anon might not feel the same way. Our fellowship has gone through many changes during the years since I've been a member. The pandemic was very hard to deal with. I have to admit, I still prefer in-person meetings. I really do. I know that Zoom and hybrid have definitely made Al-Anon available when we can't be near, but I really am glad that we've improved enough that we can be back in these rooms. I will forever have gratitude for all of you who continue to show up and do service work, who open the meetings, who set up the literature, chair the meetings, and attend the meetings so that our rooms continue to be open to anyone in need. Please consider raising your hand when someone asks for help, whether it's in a meeting, a workshop, state level, wherever. We only keep these doors open if we all help. I know that my siblings wonder why I still attend. And the same thing for Mike. He celebrated 39 years in October. But like our declaration says, let it begin with me. Someone was there with their hands out, hugs to be given, and a welcome to be shown when I walked into these rooms. And I want to be there for the newcomer who might walk into our rooms for their first meeting. Life moves on, challenges continue. We both continue to work our program using steps, traditions, and tools we deal with to deal with life as it comes. And all this, I believe that what my higher power knew I needed was someone that was gentle, loving, and caring, and that is what I got. So maybe that's another miracle and why we will celebrate 52 years of marriage this August. We have a plaque on our wall that says happiness is being married to your best friend. And I thank God that he brought Mike to my life and that we both found programs. Now, that isn't to say he doesn't still irritate the shit out of me on any certain day of the week. Must be those shortcomings that I haven't fixed in him yet. Oh, well, we're still breathing. There's still time. I'd like to close. This is my original ODAT with page 219, August 6th. This is a day which God has given into my hands. If I could only realize what a tremendous gift this is, I would use every moment of it to make my life more serene, more rewarding. I would not look back over my shoulder at the disappointments of the past. I would not anxiously contemplate the future. I would live just for today as well as I can. I would put aside critical thoughts of others. I would notice interesting things. The expressions on people's faces, a plant growing on my windowsill, not at my house, they die. The grace and charm of a child, an arrangement of clouds. Today there are wonders all around me if I will open my eyes and enjoy them. Today's reminder, let me not be so preoccupied with thoughts of my grievances and troubles that today's good can escape me. Today I can begin a new way of using my minutes and hours, a new way of looking at my surroundings and the circumstances of my life. I will make this day one I can look back upon with pleasure and satisfaction, and a preparation for the days to come. And the quote is, today is all the time I have. Nobody can keep me from using it well. If I make this a good day, tomorrow can be even better. Thank you all.